Hello, everyone. This is Dave Levinsky from GrowthInc, and I'm really excited to interview Matt Siegel. And I'm going to give Matt his own opportunity to tell you a little bit about himself and what he's done. But what's very interesting is I spoke to Matt the other day and just found out he had a wealth of knowledge on the process of companies acquiring other companies. And he's done a lot of work in that area. And I think he's going to have a lot of key insights that are going to help a lot of you that are listening to this interview grow more successful business and get result in better acquisitions. So to start, Matt, thank you so much for joining the call today.
Of course, no problem. Thanks, Dave.
Oh, great. So Matt, the first question I have is, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into providing due diligence for acquirers? And that's a key thing that you've been doing is a lot of due diligence for acquirers. Can you talk about that?
Sure, Dave. I've probably spent 60 or 70% of my career in consulting, initially strategy consulting, and due diligence really, at least my role, and it really took off in probably the middle part of the last decade, mid-2000s, when, you know, there was huge growth in private equity. And for me, coming from a strategic consulting background, it was kind of a natural evolution. You know, when you're consulting the companies and helping them grow the business, you're looking at markets, you're looking at the competitive landscape, you're looking at upside opportunities, you're looking at differentiation, and due diligence is really the, you know, kind of the other side of that coin, which is helping buyers, you know, both strategic and financial, determine, you know, really, is this a good acquisition target, you know, and what is the upside in this business? So coming from a strategy consulting background, due diligence is sort of a natural evolution of that offering.
Got it. Now, so a lot of acquirers have essentially they've hired you to conduct the due diligence process for them. Is that correct?
That's right. So we most of my work has been with private equity firms, and you know, acquisitions typically, you know, companies anywhere from, you know, a few million in revenue up to billions. Really, I've been involved in those projects, and the rationale is if a private equity firm is going to spend, you know, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions potentially on acquisition, it's worth spending a little bit upfront relative to that number to bring in an outside view and really, you know, dig under the, you know, look behind the curtain and assess the business. So, you know, these are all smart people, you know, they know business, they know companies, but getting, you know, getting that outside view. And these are typically really, you know, short, intense projects. These aren't, you know, 6-month projects. This is, okay, you know, we need to put an offer in 3 weeks, you know, we need your view on, you know, really, you know, one, whether we should, and two, you know, we need input into how we're valuing the company.
Got it. And how many of these projects, these due diligence processes have you done?
You know, I would say probably over 20 that I've been involved with, you know, maybe 12 to 15 on the buyer side. So, you know, helping companies, you know, assess an acquisition opportunity. But I've also been involved on the other side, helping a seller either position for a sale. So kind of think longer term, okay, we want to sell in a year. What do we need to do now to prepare for that? And then there's also a process called vendor due diligence, which is actually doing strategic due diligence or commercial due diligence for the seller. So it's putting together essentially the offering memorandum that goes out to market. And then the buyer will then use that as a basis for, you know, their valuation of the company.
Excellent. So you have a lot of experience. You've done this for 20 plus companies and you've done it from sort of every perspective, from the sell side, from the buy side, from the proactive buy side, from the proactive sell side as well. So this is great.
Add that, Dave, you know, kind of across industries too. I mean, we've been involved in everything from, you know, software to, you know, retail to cattle feed. I mean, really a variety of market segments and business models, which has been really educational.
Excellent. So we can't, for those listening, you really can't ask for somebody with a better background. So really, Matt, really, really excited to keep progressing. Can you talk briefly through, you know, you mentioned a 3-week process and you mentioned sort of the process, the due diligence process pre-offer in terms of how to value the company and whether they should put in an offer. Is there a material difference between due diligence that's done pre-offer, pre, you know, letter of intent versus due diligence that's conducted after the letter of intent? Have you done both, or is there a way to contrast the two?
Yeah, the big difference is, you know, from our perspective, is whether or not you have access to company information. So that, you know, is there a data room set up that has company financials, customer lists? You know, sometimes if you're early in the process, you just don't have access to that, which makes the process more difficult. You just have to get more creative. Whereas
right.
if you're further along and, you know, there's a shorter list of potential buyers and you have access to company data, you know, it's more work because you have more to sift through, but it gives you, you know, a lot more insight to the performance of the company and the potential.
Excellent. So, which leads nicely into my next question, which is, you know, what specific things do you do during the due diligence process? You know, for example, are you, you know, primary versus secondary research? Are you going through customer lists and company records, audited financials? You know, what specific things are you doing, and essentially what do companies do, that acquirers do in that due diligence process that the entrepreneurs and companies that are trying to sell their companies need to know about?
Well, there's a few approaches that we take, methodologies. The first is what I call desk research.
Okay.
So it's literally the stuff that you do at your desk. You know, this is, you know, looking at industry reports, you know, doing online searches for articles and market information. I mean, if you're looking at, you know, the shoe industry, I mean, it's going to Google and saying, you know, shoe market in Germany. I mean, it's literally, you know, analysts at the desk doing research. And that's all secondary. A big regime are interviews. And this is where you get the color. So, you know, you're doing the desk research and you know that the shoe market's growing. But, you know, until you talk to, you know, and interviews, this can be industry experts. This could be customers. This could be suppliers. It could be internal. Basically, anyone that has a view on the market or that company to lend color to what, you know, what you're finding is. This isn't scientific, but it really helps tell the story. And then the third piece is, you know, the internal data, if you have access to that, which we kind of talked about, which, you know, the customer list, the company financials, if it's a private company, which is really, really important as well. You know, and then the fourth piece on the primary side is we would often do, surveys. So, you know, end user surveys, and we'll use online tools like SurveyMonkey and get, lists of potential customers. And this is a little bit more scientific. It's still not scientific, or we'll do focus groups. But getting that, you know, that customer perspective is really critical in the process, and you can't get that, you know, by market reports or, you know, or articles.
Got it.
So that, in a nutshell, those are sort of the sources of information.
Got it. And this level of depth, is this pretty common among acquisitions, or is it something that you felt that was pretty aggressively thorough?
Yeah, this is, I mean, we're thorough, you know, and that's how we, you know, typically position ourselves, is that this isn't two interviews. I mean, this is, you know, 20 or 30 or 40. But, you know, and I would say give, you know, the size of the acquisition, you know, usually there's a bigger budget, which means more team. You know, I would say, you know, for your audience and, you know, for those maybe earlier on the process that, you know, they're not selling a company with $200-400 million, $1 billion in revenue, I would say the process is still there. So any buyer is going to want to talk to customers, is going to want to understand the market, is going to want to talk to suppliers. It might not be to that level of depth, but I think that process is still absolutely relevant, and people need to be aware that that's going to happen when they go to sell, no matter how big the company is.
Excellent. So you're doing this research, desk research and interviews, and you're looking at suppliers and customers and the market. In doing that, what are the key things that you're looking for?
It's a good question. You know, I would say there's probably maybe four or five different areas of exploration. The first one is just kind of major red flags.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything that jumps out right away that says, no, this is not a good idea, you know, and that could be that, you know, 70% of your business is with one customer, you know, and you have no contract with that long-term agreement with that customer.
Right.
It could be that you're in an industry that, you know, is there's no, you have a 70% share in an industry that's not growing. You know, where's the growth story? So, so one is red flags. Two is, I would say, generally, so once you kind of get past that, and typically, where we would be brought into the process, you're kind of beyond that. Then I think it really boils down to two questions. One is, how attractive is the market? So outside of the company, the space that they're in, how attractive is it, and is it a growing market? And then if so then there's a whole kind of regime about the market and understanding the market, the growth, the drivers. And then, if it is attractive, how is the company positioned? Basically, can the company outperform the market? So if the market's growing at 6% a year, can that company actually outperform the market? And then that's where we get into the kind of the competitive landscape, the product offering, any technical differentiation, barriers to entry, those kinds of questions. And then I would say the fourth area is really the question of upside. And this has to be achievable upside, but two, three, 4 years out, and typically buyers aren't looking to hold a company for indefinitely. There's some time horizon, and it may vary a bit between venture capital and private equity, but typically you're talking a few years. Can this acquisition achieve upside beyond the business plan in that time frame? We try to identify that early on.
Got it. What about if the market is not really clearly defined? I guess, for maybe for some technology companies, if you look at maybe a PayPal years before, before it was acquired by eBay, if you look at the sort of online payment space was sort of an emerging space and it was sort of hard to tell how big that market is. I mean, clearly it was growing. Does that change anything when you look at a company that's sort of paving a new path?
Yeah, it does, and I think there's a, and let me give you one example. We did a due diligence for a company that makes basically, it's line management. It's a post and ropes, when you're standing in a movie theater, to manage queues or lines. And they had a what they called an electronic queue management offering. And this is not, I think it's actually kind of when we read that, when we first kind of went through the memo, the offering memorandum, we're like, okay, electronic queue management, that's not, there's no defined market for that. There's no market report. So we actually spent most of our time really diving into that and trying to determine, okay, is this a real market, or is this just positioning? So again, it's just going back to those, talking to retailers. Is this something, does this offering resonate? Is this something that, you would consider? What is the value proposition? Looking at their pipeline of sales and, trying to really sift through that and try, part of what we're doing is defining a market and saying, okay, what, is there a real market here? So I think for people, new technologies, same concept. I mean, what you lose is that prime, unfortunately you can't go find a market report, but you do go through the same market sizing exercise, whether it's a defined market or not. How big is the market? What are potential penetration rates? What are potential price points, and try to back into whether, the target's business plan is realistic.
Got it. Got it. Now, a lot of what you've done is with private equity firms that that need that market, that real market data intelligence. Would you expect that strategic buyers would have less of a need to conduct that market research because they really already know because they're in the market?
It's slightly different. My thinking is that, and I think this is important for your listeners, that, as people are growing businesses, that they should do it so that the business can be a standalone. I think, and we've been involved in some of these where there's sort of a nat, you know, as there's sort of a natural strategic buyer, and that doesn't work out for, any multitude of reasons, and then people are kind of stuck. They've kind of over time, grown this business with the idea that they would sell to, either a particular buyer or a certain market. And then what happens when that doesn't work out? So I would say, so it's a little bit off your point, but generally, let's grow the business to be able to sell regardless of whether it's a financial or strategic buyer. I have worked on projects where we're brought a strategic buyer's corporate development group, and they want to take a deeper look, and they know the market better, and there's more just natural insight into the market, so you're focused less on that. But I would say more and more, the synergies and the strategic value is discounted, and people want to make sure that that business can contribute the EBITDA as a standalone to make the acquisition, worthwhile or economically feasible.
Excellent. Excellent. Can you take us through a successful due diligence process, and successful meaning that the buyer went forward with the purchase of the company? And, in such a case, what findings were uncovered in the due diligence process? And what was it about the company that made it a good acquisition candidate?
Sure. One example would be, a company. We did a project for a private equity firm that was interested in a company that they make carpet cleaning machines that you can rent at Safeways, Ralphs, at large grocery stores throughout the
Okay.
country. And again, this is, at first glance, it's okay. It's carpet cleaning. It's rental. Is this really an interesting business?
Right.
But the more we dug in, first of all, they had a complete lock on distribution. So they had already penetrated, most of the major outlets in the U.S. So they and there was no you don't need two rent carpet cleaning rental machines, and you need one. So
Right.
that was huge, just being able to defend the channel. The second one is, we talked to both, the customers, the direct customers, the channel, so the outlets, as well as the end users, and the people love the product, and to the grocery stores, this is dead space at the front of the store, so
Right.
it's just incremental revenue, and there was no investment. This is a rental business. They're basically just giving up real estate that wasn't being used anyway for, incremental revenue. They loved it.
Right.
And then the third piece that made this attractive was there was upside to grow internationally. And so a lot of our focus is actually international, looking at other markets and what was the opportunity to take this business model to other markets, internet globally. And then also, what was the opportunity to sell chemicals and other products into their current channel? So felt that there's enough upside there as well. So again, just an example that, kind of a boring business, it's not a sexy technology company, but, there's some really strong fundamentals that made it attractive.
Got it. Looks, you see the lock on distribution. Looks like it's lock on distribution. Their distribution partner's happy. The customer's happy. So they're very, the risk very, very low that revenues would decrease. And you're saying that the upsell to grow internationally and to push more products like different chemicals through the existing channels makes it a nice business.
Exactly.
Excellent. So let's look at the other side. Can you take us through an unsuccessful due diligence process where the buyer did not go forward with the purchase of the company? And in that type of case, what findings were uncovered during the due diligence process, and what was it about the company that failed to make it a good acquisition candidate?
Yeah, no problem. Let me say, usually there's, shades of gray. It's not a
Right.
binary, yes or no. Once you kind of get past that red flag stage, then it becomes, how much are we willing to pay for this company? So a lot of, our work was is becomes kind of input into that decision. What multiple, willing to pay higher multiple if we really believe that there's upside, or that, if there's some risk here, we're not, there's a lower multiple, we're not willing to pay as much. So,
Right.
I'd say that in that previous case, it was probably the former. It was more attractive. I'd say one that was probably less attractive was a company that makes what are called physiological shoes. These are the
Okay.
shoes that, I think you actually see a lot of commercials now for like Skechers, where you wear the shoe, and by wearing the shoe and walking around the house, you're actually working out theoretically.
Right.
And this was one of the first companies in that space. This was a few years ago, and people actually really liked the product. We did a lot of we did some focus groups and customer polling, and people who own the product actually really liked it. But there were a couple key problems here. One is it was kind of fashion trendy. So, and these were actually not attractive shoes, but because they were so unattractive, there's a kind of a trendy element to it that we're concerned about. You know, and trends are something I think your listeners should be aware of, that, you know, I don't think buyers like trends. You know, I think they're afraid of trends. So if you're seen as being in a trendy industry space product, you know, that's just something to be aware of. But anyway, in this case, there was, you know, it was, we felt like there's some fashion risk. The second point was a really high price point, which actually limited the number of what we call doors or outlets for the product. So in other words, you know, if a product is, you know, this product, and this applies to really any, you know, manufactured good. Let's say this product hypothetically was over $200. You know, you walk into a Champs Sporting Goods or, you know, Sports Chalet, you're not going to find that price point there. So in their plan, when they were talking about, you know, channels and the upside on channels, it didn't fit with the pricing of the product. So that was a big one. We just didn't feel like they could get the number of doors required to meet the business plan projections. And then the third piece here was the threat of entrance. You know, they didn't have a patent on the technology, or at least a concept. So, you know, our concern was always, you know, some big player could just come into the space once it got well known and make products, which I think like Skechers has done. So that'd be a case where, you know, probably for a buyer, the risk, you know, there was higher risk, so it would imply potentially a lower multiple.
Got it. So with the high risk, once again, you're with the shades of gray, you're saying that still companies would want to acquire this company, but it would be a much lower price than if it did, if some of these factors didn't exist. Is that correct?
Potentially, yeah. Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, it's just a function of risk. I mean, you know, just your kind of fundamental economic principle that people will pay, you know, more for low risk. You know, there's just a risk premium, so which would imply a lower price, basically. You know, higher risk, lower price. It doesn't necessarily mean someone's going to drop out of the race to acquire.
Got it. And can you go through? You started mentioning, like in the physiological shoes example, you mentioned, you know, fashion risk and risk of not enough, you know, doors or outlets. And then you mentioned a couple of red flags earlier. Can you spend a little more time on that? You know, what are those, you know, sort of general risks and red flags that acquirers are going to stand out to acquirers that the people listening should really make note of so that they can make sure they avoid those risks in their business. Like you mentioned the customer concentration example earlier with, you know, one customer without even a contract at 70% of revenue. So can you talk through any thoughts you have on that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that's a big one. So that's actually a bit, so one of the first questions we always ask is, you know, looking at that customer, what is the distribution of revenues, you know, and profits between customers or among customers? And not just what it is today, but what's the trend, is which way is it trending? So that, I would say that's really critical. You know, another one I would say is you know, it's kind of an overused term, but barriers to entry. So just, you know, is the position defensible, you know, or, you know, whether, you know, we talked about the lock-on distribution, you know, is there some, we talked about IP, you know, so, you know, if it could be a really nice business, but, you know, if there's really nothing defensible there, that could be a red flag. You know, I'd say another one would be the market itself. Is it a vulnerable market? You know, generally, again, a company could be performing very well in a market that, you know, might not be here in 5 years. So, you know, and there's, you know, tons of examples and technology of that. So, you know, that would be a red flag. Just the company, you know, the company is doing well, but, you know, this market is a risk. You know, there's a real threat of, you know, some new technology coming in and replacing the market. And then I would also say, this notion of headroom. So a red flag, just this, is there room for growth, basically? So, just a real fundamental question is, someone has a high share in a relatively slow growing market, where can they grow? They can't get more share. So, in terms of red flags, that's, it's not a comprehensive list, but those are some of the key red flags that we would look for.
Got it. Now, what if a company said, okay, they have, let's say they have a huge market share, 70% in one market, but they say, we believe our product service can be applied to another market, but they haven't gone into that other market yet. Would you recommend they have to go into the other market yet to prove that they have that headroom, or just say they think that it can? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and it's a really good point, Dave. I mean, there's a big difference between saying you can and actually having some track record. And the difference is oftentimes, can a buyer underwrite that upside? So can they actually get the financing for that? What is believable? And so, because every, and you've seen it, every business plan, every offering memorandum has all this upside there, and why this company is going to be a billion-dollar company, or why this technology that's in the restaurant industry is applicable to retail, which is a much bigger, market. I don't know. But the question, do they have, retail customers? And it doesn't have to be half their business, but do they have an actual foothold in that new market, which is really critical. So I think, as your listeners are thinking about their businesses and selling down the road and when to sell, they may believe 100%, yeah, this, there's huge upside here because you take this technology and you apply this market, but really focus on making that credible, that argument credible with pilots, with customers, with, something beyond just a rationale on paper.
Excellent. What about you just mentioned the phrase when to sell, and I was wondering if you had any thought and insight into the ideal time to sell a business.
Yeah, it's funny. I had dinner with a friend last night. And we were talking about that because he's thinking about selling his business, and I was actually asking him that question, like, when do you sell? I don't think there's a right answer to that because I think it's the motivation of the individual, and it's what he or she wants to get out of their business and life and personal life. So it's really hard to comment on that. I would say, and I don't, I have some experience in this. People have more experience, but from what I've seen, they're part of his gut, just, you've got to be at a point where you've done what you want to do financially. So if you sell, you kind of make what you want, but you don't, but there's still upside on the table. There's still, you're still growing quickly. I think what happens oftentimes is, people ride that growth, they ride that growth, and they hold on, they hold on. And then at some point, things level off. Well, at that point, that business becomes a little bit less attractive.
So you want to get it on the upswing.
Exactly. So I think, but human nature is, well, it's trending up. Why, let's ride it for another year or two. Just like selling your house, same thing. People, okay, I've made 40% on my house. Well, when I get to 80% or 100%, I'll sell. Well, you never get there. So I think people just need to be reasonable and not fall in love with the idea of a certain number, and I think inside a lot of people know when it's time to get out.
Got it. And in addition, correct me if I'm wrong, if your company is interested in attacking new markets and wants to, show the acquirer that it does have that huge potential of going to that new market, they would have to first actually prove their penetration in that new market. Is that correct?
I think it depends. I mean, there's a lot of variables that influence that. I think for it to actually impact the value of the company, like the multiple, or the valuation model. So when you're actually kind of doing the cash flow out on revenue and profits down the road, that yes, there has to be, for it to be credible, there has to be some sort of penetration or track record. I think you can still, you can always, and you always want to tell the upside story and get people excited, and that, I think there is some benefit in doing that. But I personally think it's important to, and when we're doing due diligence, that's a lot of what we did was, okay, how credible is this upside story? So I think it's important, but that, it's just one opinion.
Excellent. Excellent. Next question I have is what are the top five areas that you think entrepreneurs should focus on in order to build a sellable business?
Top five. Let me put some out there. I'm not sure if I'll get to five, but I would say, the first one is the I think the market is key, and positioning in a high growth market. And you alluded to it, Dave, that what if the market's not defined? But I think really having a good story about the market that you're in, and why this is, if it is defined, why your company, your business is in a high growth market. And if it's not defined, define it, and in a way that's attractive and exciting. So that's one. So positioning high. I would say the, and again, this is kind of an overused term, but diversification. So, don't put all your eggs in one basket, as they say, either in terms of customer, or product. And as a buyer, I would say I would look at a business, and we talked about the red flags on customer concentration. Same thing on product. Are you basing all your, do you have one product? Are you, and if that thing, if you lose that, you're done. Or if they're, a competitor gains share with that product, you're done. So I think diversification is important. Now, for a lot of smaller companies, that's something to strive toward. You can't get that off the bat. You need to first, get the company off the ground. But over time, I think that's important. I would say, really have a plan. So thinking, prospectively about, what is that 5-year plan? And it doesn't have to be some deep strategic planning process, but really having a vision for the company, which is hard in smaller companies because you're worried about keeping your head above water, and but always keep, have a plan, and it'll change, but having kind of that end game in mind, I think is important. I think, and we talked about it before, I think, but building a standalone business. So ensuring that, I mean, if the goal is to sell and you know that now, making sure that decisions you make today position the business as an attractive standalone target, meaning you're not dependent on, a single strategic buyer or, an industry to buy you, that this is really a business that can survive and thrive on its own. And then I'm not sure how many were, but one more would be, I think, differentiation. And again, a pretty overused term, but doing due diligence, I look at, is there something different about this company versus competitors? I mean, again, a company can be successful in the short term, but unless you have something that's truly differentiated, over time, that value will get eroded. And that's also, through the due diligence process, what we're looking for is this sustainable? Is your business sustainable? Not just over the next, 3 or 4 year horizon, which I may own it, but then I presumably am selling it to someone else. So I need to have a story for them. So that's really key and something to build into the business early on.
Excellent. So actually, you got the five. So great job on that. One of the things I want to just dive a little bit in deeper on is product diversification. How much diversification? So let's take the shoe company example. Would diversification be having, four different models of the shoe, or would it have to be also selling socks and jerseys? And how much diversification is required?
I would say in that case, it's not necessarily, complementary products like shirts. I would say, in that case, I would look at diversification as, really, I would say, price points, in that
Okay.
particular case. So having,
Right.
We talked about the $250 price, the high price point, which limited the doors. But could you have a down market shoe at $80 or $70, targeting a different segment? So in that case, I would look at a diversification from a price point perspective.
Okay.
Diversification can be, geographic. So, if maybe, trends in the US aren't that okay. Let me give you another example. We did a project for a laminate flooring manufacturer that was based in Europe. And, the laminate flooring trends at the time were slowing down in Europe, actually. Your penetration was already pretty high, but really starting to take off in the US. So there I'd look at diversification. If we were just looking at the European market, it would not be an attractive acquisition, but looking at a global business, it was. So that, in that case, diversification was geographic. So I look at it more as a hedge, just to make sure that, okay, if something happens here, because I think buyers are always thinking about the downside risk. So the more diversified you are in terms of customers, product, geography, just the less risk. And, as we talked about, the risk is correlated directly with price.
Excellent, excellent, very, very helpful. Next question I have is what big mistakes have you seen companies make that hurt their chances of getting to a successful sale?
Yeah, it's sort of the back end of what we were just talking about in the red flag conversation. I think it's just ultimately, and I get involved kind of later in the process when there's always already kind of a sale in mind. But you see a lot of examples of companies that just don't, they don't get that far, And to me, it's really, and what you guys do at Growth Inc., which is really helping companies kind of get over that hurdle, right? So it's, putting together, it's having the plan, which is really important. It's starting with the end in mind, which is critical. It's really understanding your markets and your competitive landscape. It's being prospective about what you're doing, versus, which is hard to balance when you're in survival mode. So, it's hard to point to, one or two factors. I think it's all that. I think successful companies, just they have a vision and they execute, and things change, but they're always looking down the road and they're always keeping, these kind of elements that we talked about in mind, whether it's, diversification, the product itself, the competitive landscape, how to, create a barrier to entry. I mean, you just have to be really thoughtful about how you're addressing these.
Excellent. Now, this next question, I know you've talked about this a bit, but any additional insights on, what do you think makes the difference between a good and a great acquisition candidate? The great acquisition candidate being the one that sort of everyone wants to buy and at the highest multiples. What are the attributes of that great acquisition candidate?
I would say one is the customer voice. So, and we, and I think in any due diligence process, people will talk to the customer, but that you can't get around that. If people have great things to say about the product or company, that's invaluable. We did one project was for a retailer of containers, and again, it's, again, they sell containers, but the level of customer service, was incredible, and people would pay a premium for these containers because they love the environment. They love the people who work there were really well trained and had, they're not, they weren't there for 6 months or a year. These are people that have been, working there 10, 12 years, love the company. And so that, that's an intangible that you can't replicate, on paper. So, takeaway for, I think for your listeners is constantly, talking to your customers, making sure your customers are satisfied, really focusing on the customer, I think is critical. And then the other one I would say that we talked about a bit was on the upside that is credible. So a good acquisition candidate is an attractive business. They're in a growing market. They've got some kind of defensible position. Customers like them. That's good. That's good. Okay, great. I think a great one is all that plus, okay, they've got now four customers in this space over here, or in India, or in this with this new product, And if we
Mm-hmm.
kind of layer that into what they're currently doing, wow, there's huge potential here,
Gosh, a huge upside.
Yeah, exactly. But again, it goes back to it being credible versus a story on in some business plan.
Got it. So it's everything plus really proving out the headroom and the upside potential.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, excellent. Makes sense.
And actually, Dave, that kind of goes to the timing point. Could a, someone listening here, could they take, if they spend, okay, one more year, okay, we're in a position to sell, but let's take it a year and really get a foothold into this market. Oftentimes it's worth doing, and it just makes that story sellable.
Gosh, you're saying it sounds like it's worth spending that extra year to prove that upside potential, penetrate the new market, and get a much, much higher price. Is that correct?
Yeah, it could be. It could be something to think about,
Got it. Agreed.
when you're kind of weighing timing.
Excellent. Great point. What's the first thing that you recommend our listeners do after they're done listening to this call to start preparing themselves to successfully sell their business at the highest price?
First, I would say write the storyboard. I mean, literally, maybe take a piece of paper and kind of write the story, next year, 3 years, 5 years, whatever you think your time horizon is. I mean, if you're actually going to sell this company and you're going to write that story, what does that story look like? How big is the company? What is the, EBITDA? How are you defining your market? Who are your competitors at that time? What does your customer base look like? How are you differentiated? What patents do you have? I mean, physically writing that story, I think will help people start thinking about, okay, where are some of the gaps, in that story, and over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, what do we need to do to get the most for this company? What gaps do we need to fill? Because if you start that process, when you hire the banker, it's too late. Then it becomes a sales job versus something fundamental.
Excellent, Matt. Phenomenal information. I hope that I was just taking. I'm on my fourth page of notes typing, so I'm assuming everyone else listening as well took got a lot of this call. My final thing would be: is there anything that I might have missed that you think the entrepreneurs and business owners listening should know about?
Only, I think it's important. I think probably most of your listeners and customers have a passion for what they do, passion for the business, and I would say that's a, it's an intangible that doesn't, that shows up in value down the road, but I think most of your listeners probably have a head start on other people because by definition they have a passion for what they're doing, So I think that passion, for whatever the business is, or the product is, combined with some, forethought on some of the things we talked about today, should actually be a really a potent equation. So, I just think that it's just something you can't value, but again, I think people on on this call or listening, hopefully are kind of have that head start. Because that's really important.
Excellent. Everyone, I've been speaking with Matt Siegel. Matt, once again, some incredible information. Really, really appreciate your time today.
Okay, Dave. No, anytime. No problem. Thanks.